I never forget the first moment when I walked into a cinema. I was hooked from there on.
Hello and welcome to the Scan On Podcast, your weekly look at the world of film, Irish and international. I'm Darren Mooney, and joining me are...
Jay. And Ronan, hello.
And so this week we'll cover the usual, which include the weekend film news, the top 10, and the new releases. But let's start with what we normally start with, which is, what have you watched this week, Jay?
Not bad, a decent amount. A very respectable amount, one would say. And I'll kick that off with...
He has his printout again.
I do, but...
Very reassured.
Some paper rustles.
Somebody... Somebody does research in this program. Anyway. I will kick off with Meek's Cutoff, which I've never seen before. The Kelly Reichardt Western. Refresh my memory on this one.
I think I've seen those.
This is kind of a yeah. It's a wagon kind of trail going across.
Is it Oregon?
Oregon, yeah. And they're basically trying to get. They have a guy with them who was Stephen Meeks, who was basically bringing them to across kind of dangerous lands to. You know, safety, but he may or may not know where he's going. I hadn't seen this one before. I've been catching up on the Reichardt films that I've missed in the last while, so this is the latest one. And it's really, really interesting. Reading a bit after I've watched it, there's a lot of talk about how slow it is and how, quote-unquote, nothing happens.
Yeah.
That's kind of the point to some degree, I would imagine, because because of the nature of the story it is and the kind of getting lost, crisscrossing landscapes,
yes.
The whole kind of just sense of it's an alien kind of part of the world almost once you get to a certain point of space where nothing is there. So nothing happens, but it's everything. It's the existential end of the line in the sense of, and very much in the Western sense, we get like death as a kind of an oblivion, always staring you in the face. And these are weighty themes that are kind of very, very delicately layered in. They're not. This isn't shouting at you in that way, and perhaps that probably accounts for the not necessarily mute response. There are huge fans of it as well, as people that are a bit kind of, I don't know about it. But it worked really well for me. The Academy ratio that it's shot in works stupendously well for trapping characters, particularly, which I really, really liked. And Michelle Williams, because she is incredible, is also incredible in this because she's incredible in practically everything. and works wonders here. It's somebody who...
So, Jay, we're booking your ticket to Venom right now, right?
Oh, God, is she in that?
Yeah.
Listen,
there's a recent interview with
Williams, and, you know, she was kind of saying that she kind of broke out of the kind of... that kind of smaller film thing to do a couple of reruns. And, you know, as long as it pays for a nice house or whatever, I'm fine with that.
Which it doesn't
Having
in the case of
said
all the money in the world.
I will not be going to see Venom. Yeah. For many reasons. Tom Hardy. being
Jay's
one of them. But,
cinema of experience continues.
Does it though, Darren? Does
Despite
it?
Quite yet having started.
But Meek's Cutoff is great. I've still a couple more to do before I'm kind of caught up with Richard.
What else haven't you seen?
Well, I haven't seen the earlier ones. Something to Joy, is it?
Old Joy is possibly my favourite.
There's one before it.
River of Grass.
That's the one. The only two I haven't seen now.
They're all really terrific. And I think the thing I really, really like about Meek's Cutoff, as you were saying, the Academy ratio for the Western, it's this sort of ironic thing that you've got those traditional vistas.
Yeah, the John Ford landscape vistas.
She's very much into containing those in the same way she contains her characters.
But it's nonetheless spectacular for her, either.
Yeah, American exceptionalism and the frontier narrative. Boxing it in new ways, and to do something new with the Western isn't easy these days.
Nope.
I think she does it terrifically.
And I was actually only chatting on Twitter today with somebody about the fact that there are so precious few women led or women directed Westerns.
Yeah.
And I think it's an epic kind of space for women to step into, I would imagine, because there's so many stories that could be
can
told,
be told
in,
yeah.
And you can even reuse all the kind of classic tropes but from a very, very different perspective.
Yep.
And I'd be happy to
and
see
certainly
it.
Certainly very
continues.
Timely at a point where America's
very much
with
so.
Its masculinity.
And now you can rewrite the rewritten history if you like. So yeah. it'd be fascinating to see more.
And it's great in narrative terms as well that the narrative is literally the story of a man insisting he knows what he's doing with the woman following
him
around and saying, are you sure? Because I think
it's
where
we're going. Yeah. Literally that story. It's great.
It's got that kind of dry humour about it.
Yeah, I told you I laughed a little bit all the way through it. And it's telling his old horny stories about how he shot down somebody in back of Dakota or whatever. And it's like, you're such a butcher to me. We've all been that guy.
Oh, I need to go back and see
it. It's good.
Again.
It's really, really good. Next time I rewatched The Obvious Child, the Gillian Roseberry film with Jenny Slate.
Yeah.
Which I love. And I've seen, I think it was 3 or 4 times at this stage.
Charming little film.
It's great. It's really funny. It's
the
not many
comedy
that you never knew you needed or wanted. And Slate is absolutely fantastic, and perhaps should have got more recognition for the role. It's this kind of, oh, she's playing a comedian, she's a comedian, ergo she's not acting, which I think is absolutely nonsense. I think she's really, really good. There's a lot more going on than that. And Jake Lacy, who's the kind of straight guy in it, does a lot of great work as well with a kind of a thankless, not thankless role, but certainly it's a very straight run role. But he plays very well in it, and exactly.
He has that sort of niche. Like, he did that very well in Miss Sloan with Jessica Chastain.
I didn't see that. Is he in that too?
Well, Their Finest, if I remember correctly, was he the American in that?
That's right.
But he does that sort of nice bumbling, sort of like Cary Grant, if Cary Grant were the female love interest, sort of thing.
I love that. No, but he's good, and he does it really well. It's a quite restrained film. Actually, despite the kind of it's kind of not graphic, but it's kind of, you know, full on occasion, but the story is really good. It's, as I kind of chatted about it, like, it's kind of a romantic comedy in a way.
It works and
fits well. Maybe it's not as tropey to some degree, but it works really well in that regard. And I really like how it resolves itself is very straight and true to the rest of the film, as opposed to true to the narrative conventions that maybe people would expect. Like, it follows through on its projection very well. Like, it doesn't kind of go, oh, well, we want the happy ever after, so this is what you get. I really liked it.
For a good while, it was my go-to film for, you know, when friends come to you and say, oh, what's something I should watch on Netflix? For a long time, I said that, and I ended up watching it with a bunch of people. I think I've watched it 4 or 5 times just because somebody would say, oh, what do we watch? And say, obviously, I'll happily watch that again and again and again.
Me too. And she's a new film now, Rob Spare, Landline, which was released last year in the States.
Relatively low key.
And it's not a sign of it. And I've asked Niall, there's not a sign of it for distribution over this side of the world. I suspect it's on kind of American VOD kind of thing, so I'm trying to watch it at some
point.
Not that
we would condone
it. Well, I'm going to do it regardless. Because I really want to see it. And if it's not going to get released, I'm going to bloody see it. And Slate's in it as well again, so which I'm very much into that.
So that's slated for late in
Indeed. Very, very, very good, Aaron. Very good. The other one I really want to talk about, and I apologise for bringing La La Land back into conversation. I know there's a moratorium.
Oh boy.
Is The Umbrellas of Cherbourg.
Ah.
Which I have never seen before. Yes, indeed, Darren. Which is the Jacques Demy musical set in Cherbourg, of all places. It's a really, really interesting film. I'd never seen it before. I'd known of it, but I've never kind of read up on it, didn't know much about it. Until I was like kind of skipping along through my Filmstruck library and go, ooh, I'll watch that of a Sunday morning. And it's absolutely terrific. It's extremely interesting film about kind of ploughing forward in your life despite the heartache of losing out on love and kind of the variations of that story. It's about a young woman who lives in Cherbourg and she lives with her mother and they run a little kind of a shop, hat shop I think it is, and she's kind of in a relationship with this young guy who gets conscripted into the army and has to go to Algeria, and so she kind of marries somebody else while he's in the army, but she also is pregnant by him. So it's kind of this story then of kind of that regret and that loss, and then kind of trying to hold together. And it's just really, really beautiful. The artifice of it and the colours in it are incredible. And Varda, who was Jacques Demy's wife, had kind of continued the kind of, there was a restoration project for them in the early 90s, and she kind of, after he died, kind of made kind of efforts to restore the colours on it, because the film was shot on really faded badly, apparently, the original negatives and stuff like that. So the restored cut of it, I guess, that I watched, the colours popping, and I really, really want to see on the big screen. I can only imagine it looks sensational. And La La Land does take a direct inspiration from
very
it.
Much very so. Much so.
And that there's worse films to kind of take inspiration from. I mean, I don't think they quite get there, but I can know exactly what they were trying to do with it. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's a very kind of wonderful film. And I think it even attempts the kind of bittersweet ending that The Umbrellas of Cherbourg has. It doesn't get near as emotive and wonderfully moving as this does. But again, you know, if you're going to crib and kind of use it, it's
steal from
the best. Yeah, so, I mean, and I'm being gentle on...
Inspiration borrows genius
skills. Indeed, indeed. But Umbrellas of Cherbourg is absolutely fantastic. Fantastic film. Anyway, two more then before I leave you. I watched The End of the Tour, which is...
I haven't seen this for ages.
This is really... This has been... Yes, I'm going to say yes. It's on the Netflix I watched.
All right.
But I'm not suggesting that my Netflix may be the same as your Netflix, asterisk. But it may well be on your Netflix.
That's a
the poor
very good
people's
answer.
Netflix,
that's
if you
a very
will.
Good answer, Jerry.
But it's on all the Netflixes, maybe.
But I remember hearing great stuff about this 2 years ago, and I wanted to watch it. It didn't get a big release over here theatrically.
No.
I remember finding it, seeing it was at maybe in the Lighthouse of the IFI one weekend where I wasn't in Dublin.
Yeah.
And basically missing it as a result and wanting to see it.
Well, the interesting about it is I kind of, and I won't say dismissed it, but I kind of saw it, I was like, it has that American indie kind of look about it. And
you mean starring Jesse Eisenberg?
And
Jason Segel,
but it has that kind of
about,
you know,
David Foster
Wallace. Had all, it kind of felt a little I don't know, but I had a few people recommend it to me fairly recently, so I said, right, I'll give it a look, and I really liked it. I haven't read any David Foster Wallace. I've Infinite Jest sitting on my bookshelf for the last, I don't know, many years, all 1,000 pages going to read me. It's like, who has the time? I could be like 10 books in that time, but I will get to it at some point, maybe. But the film is really good. It's a really interesting, complex relationship between Foster Wallace and David Lipsky. I think he wrote for Rolling Stone, and he spends like 5 days in his company. And I don't know, I think he lives in Minnesota. I think it is snowy, kind of just crappy little house. You know, he looks like not next step up from homeless almost. You know, it's kind of like, what, this is the great writer, like. And it's really interesting that Lipsky himself had written a couple of books, so he has that kind of, if I rub off on genius, maybe I'll be a better writer. Thing, complex, and it's really interesting in that regard. It plays with the kind of, Lipsky clearly has a better social standing than Foster Wallace, but not in terms of
ability
and in terms of being famous and celebrity, and the idea of people looking at Foster Wallace and going, oh my god, you're one of the greatest things that's ever happened in American literature. Where Lipsky is like, oh, this is my guy here. Like, and Eisenberg plays it really well. Segel is very, very good. They're both very good, actually. They're two terrific performers to anchor it.
I heard that, yeah.
And it's like, it's just, you think it was going to have this kind of blowout scenes. There's certain, like, I've had this thing before, and I've said it before, about the Sundance film. Yeah. That there's almost like a certain point that, you know, a beat's going to be here, and a beat's going to be here. And it kind of largely stays away from that. It kind of keeps a really low key, kind of cold, wintry feel to the film, and a kind of sad feel to it, pretty much all the way to its conclusion. And it's all the better for it. Like, so, like, yeah, it's really good. Well worth a watch. So, you know, get on it, Darren.
All right, then.
And last, I will talk about Isle of Dogs, which I'd missed on its cinema run, and so I was very much looking forward to catching up on, because I'm a huge Anderson fan. So I was like, you know, give me new Wes Anderson, let me have it. And no. It did not work for me pretty much at all. I understand why people love it.
Mm-hmm. He says, looking directly at
me. At Darren, I know Darren's a big fan.
I'm a huge fan. It's probably in my top 10
years far. But I can see why that can be. Like, I can watch it, and I can see all the moving parts that
add up to, whatever.
Exactly. Like, it's really poetic. It's really elegant. It's
beautiful.
As an Anders film, as composed immaculately as you'd expect it to be. And all that kind of thing is great. But similarly to the only other Anderson film I'm not a big fan of, there's only two, this and Moonrise Kingdom.
Wow.
They feel scattered, and they feel a little, the beats in them feel perfunctory, they feel a little...
That's interesting, because Moonrise Kingdom was a point where it really clicked.
It's just the only times I find, you know, because Anderson gets this thing where he's a cold director, and he gets a kind of label out of it.
Because he's so detached and
formal.
So,
yeah, exactly. I've never found that with him. I find some of the films, quite a few of the films, quite moving, actually, and really interesting. But Moonrise Kingdom, I found that I could see behind it, and this similarly, and also, Jesus Christ, Japan, really? I think... If I'm being really nice, it's pointless to do it. If I'm not being really nice, it's extremely tasteless. And I'm not sure what benefit it brings to the film, and I'm not sure whether he knows that. And that's kind of worrying, because other than Atomic Annihilation and Sumo Wrestlers and the various other little bits, I'm not sure why they're there. They don't really add that to the story. They don't really do anything except have background kind of colour. And that's kind of worrying, because Anderson, I found it less offensive in some ways than...
I think it has to be an island. But
what's the Indian, the one that's set in India?
The Darjeeling Limited.
I found it less offensive than that.
Darjeeling is...
What? You found the Darjeeling less offensive than this?
Than this, which is not saying much. I mean, Darjeeling, I think, gets at something a little more emotionally interesting than... But still has the... problematic issue around.
Using India as a prop for our spiritual New Age enlightenment.
This makes this for me. This feels like he hasn't learned anything in that way, and that's worrying.
I would agree with that.
Yeah, but I feel like he worked with a collaborator from Japan on this as well.
I agree, and I did read it, and he wrote the script.
Yeah. Yeah, no, but I mean...
Fine, and I've seen these part of the script thing as well, like on actors and stuff. Fine, but I think that's just to deflect accusations of that, I would suggest.
And I find that... Okay, I'm wary of making that accusation.
I understand that, but everything I see in the film points that way for me. I know it doesn't point that way for everyone, and that's fine. And I can see why people like it. There's a lot in there to like, and some of the voice work is great. And the stuff about, you know, there's rumor, you know, that kind of stuff, and it keeps circling back, which I really enjoyed. Things like that always, because it's Jeff Goldblum chatting to other dogs, like, so it's you know, there's fun in there. I'm not suggesting for a second it's not, and that there's not good stuff and worthy stuff in it. Like, Anderson's a superb filmmaker, but this was just not for me, alas, sadly.
It worked more for me, but I found myself at no point emotionally connected to it.
I'll be interested to see how it ages. It'll be really interesting how people see it 5 years from now. Mm-hmm. You know, both culturally and as a film. Like, I'd be really fascinated to see.
I suppose that depends on what follows.
Well, indeed.
What happens with a film like this is you typically need to contextualize it in the
Director's work. And I think, Darren, you made a point about the kind of dogs in cages and stuff and how kind of relevant that is.
Well,
and
how that's aged since the film was released.
I think you can find that in there, definitely. I completely agree with you. And it does add a certain layer to this, particularly the first half of the film. So I'm not disagreeing with that, but that's perhaps the best I can say about it.
Right, so Ronan, what did you watch this week?
So I caught a couple of things that I liked a lot and a couple of things I didn't, which is just how we
classic
work,
Ronan.
Usually. Full spread. One surprise for me, not in a good way, was Guadagnino's A Bigger Splash, which I never caught at the time and just did not get into.
Really?
I'm kind of with Ronan on this.
It really
I haven't seen it. I've just heard people rave about it.
Yeah,
it,
I was the same. I'd heard raves throughout, and I'm a huge fan of Call Me By Your Name. We're leading up to his Suspiria, so I had it recorded on my DVR. I thought, okay, this sounds like something I'd like to watch now. And it has that thing. I think the best description I can give it of it's like Sexy Beast if Ben Kingsley was Ralph Fiennes and really annoying. Which is pretty much what happens in it. He just appears and starts being incredibly annoying, not remotely threatening.
I would also add, and just a call back to my Sundance Beats, that scene, the famous scene is the Sundance Beat scene, if you know what I mean.
We can
put it out as a clip. It's going to be amazing. We're so great this
week.
It's the singing bit.
The film, I had a bit of fun with it. Like, there's stuff in there to admire, but I was left cold by the end of it.
There's a lot I like about it, but an awful lot more that I disliked. I think Swinton is strangely misused. I like the idea of backing her into a corner where the idea is that she's a singer who's looking after her voice so she can't speak, so she's mostly just performing physically, which she's very good at.
But the
film never manages to do anything interesting with that. So you're just largely left with Schoenaerts angrily looking at Fiennes being really annoying.
And Schoenaerts can do that. Look angrily at stuff. That's kind of his bit.
It's just not got much going on, and I found it very much throughout the whole thing. I was very conscious of Guadagnino having no real experience of the kind of things he was putting in the background. It's the kind of film that throughout you hear on the radio that there's a migrant crisis going on in the distance.
All that irritating
and
head
it slowly builds up to something where you think you're saying something profound, but this doesn't relate to your lived experience, and it's window dressing. I found it kind of offensive.
I'd agree. That's
it has
unnecessary.
A sort of third act twist that tries to do something with that, but it doesn't amount to anything as far as I was concerned. Being very vague here because it's been 2 years. But it's,
I feel like that the moratorium on prestige movie spoilers is long past.
It feels as if the film desperately wants to subtly say something meaningful, but it's not very subtle and it's not very meaningful.
I think the thing with the second part of it is like it's a weird tonal shift, I thought.
It is, and it doesn't work.
Yeah, tonal shifts are fine if you can
pull them off.
If you can make it fluid, but they don't. And I wasn't convinced about what came after. Like, before, I thought the first hour, there was a lot in there to enjoy. But it was all build-up and no trousers, really, to be honest.
Build-up and no trousers.
If I'm mixing them up a little bit, I'm going to go with that. I'm going to keep
that. I like that. I'm using that from now on. Then if we move on to happier territory, the IFI's bigger picture last month was Victor Victoria, the Blake Edwards musical, which I'd never seen, from 82 with Julie Andrews.
Oh. I'd never seen it either.
It's kind of exactly the kind of thing that I felt in the mood for, a musical midweek. and it's terrific. It's, you know, really, I guess the 80s, by that point, you'd gotten reasonably progressive in terms of, you know, the way society was moving in the States, especially. It's set in 30s Paris,
okay.
And there are a lot of extremely out queer characters, and it's got this whole thing going on. Julie Andrews is a down-and-out singer who can't get a job in any of the bars in Paris, and she meets this gay pianist and entertainer who's just been fired, and together, through a hilarious sort of comic sequence where they run into each other, they decide in one of these roundabout weird ways that Julie Andrews will pretend to be a man who then pretends to be a woman. So Julie Andrews is performing.
This is a far song with
Teletherapy. Julie Andrews is performing as a drag artist, essentially. So there are
layers,
three levels of performance going on in the film. And it gets in a really, you know, it's a musical, it's a comedy, it's extremely lighthearted, but in that very restrained way, it gets at, you know, talking about the performativity of gender, sexuality. It's way ahead of its time. And it went down absolutely brilliantly with the crowd. It was the funniest film I've seen in a very long time. I was in fits at it.
I don't know, Blake Edwards films are the Pink Panther ones, which I would have been a fan of when I was younger.
Yeah,
I can't imagine you've aged well in a lot of ways. But when I was a kid, you were all I needed in my life, probably.
But it's almost, it feeds well into this kind of thing where it's just pure silliness.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But here it's backed up with something that's really quite subversive, in the way musicals can be a lot of the time.
Yeah.
Really impressive. Julie Andrews is terrific. Yeah, there are a lot of really impressive performances. And I have to say, you know, the setups, there are a lot of scenes, there's a lot of physical comedy in it, and, you know, a lot of long, long setups and terrific payoffs. I really, like, knocked me off my feet. It was not quite what I was expecting at all.
Very good.
It's always great to see the, I think the IFI's bigger picture strand is normally, it's got a lot of things like that.
Really interesting.
You may not have a chance to come across, so it was great to be able to, in my case, visit, not revisit this. But it went down so well with the crowd.
Sold.
What else? Possibly something that you may have talked about last week, Aliens?
We didn't.
Oh, really?
So you tend to keep me away from it. That's
good. Let's go to town.
So
poor Grace is going to knock out. She'd be here fuming to defend it.
I will happily step into the Grace room.
Okay.
I happily signed up for a ticket because I'm, you know, keen to see whatever 70mm projections we're lucky enough to get. I have never been a huge fan of Aliens. I love Alien, and Aliens for me has... I had, you know, my original relationship with Aliens was, oh, it sort of goes in a complete different direction to Alien. Over time, I've sort of matured and realized that's the point. It's doing its own thing, because you can't stack up against Alien, essentially. We've seen Scott's tried to do that himself with very, very mixed results in recent years.
Darren, don't say a word.
I like Covenant.
What?
Oh, good lord, okay.
That's an interesting choice.
There's an about... I was not expecting
that.
Yeah.
The podcast is full of twists today.
Trying to keep things everyone on their toes. Yeah. So there's no point in even trying to compete with Alien, especially if you're James Cameron, because he doesn't do that kind of thing. I just don't go for a lot of what Aliens does try to do. There's a lot of sort of interesting things there about family structure and motherhood, and it does further the idea of Ripley as this great feminist action hero.
It does in an interesting way, in that, like,
in a way that's sort of at times concerning.
It very much pushes against Alien in a way that's interesting for a sequel, and which I kind of admire about it, is that we live in this age where franchises now have these big fans who protect canon and continuity, and this idea of purity, and the idea that, like, once you've made a film, if you're making a sequel to it, your entire purpose is to be faithful to that film. Yeah. So I kind of like that Cameron takes a gigantic grenade, not just literally in terms of genre, in terms of going from horror to being action, but also in terms of core themes, because Alien thematically is about the inversion and rejection and perversion of gender in many ways, shape, or forms. It's about a vagina that rapes your mouth. It's also about, you know, a woman who turns out to be the action hero, which surprised absolutely everybody. In the original cut, she
pregnant
was having
man.
An affair, pregnant man, that sort of stuff. It has all mother, the you know, the cold alien spaceship, that sort of stuff. So Scott's film is very much about rejecting or perverting or sort of bending these norms and expectations. And what Cameron does is he streamlines them a great deal. So you have the reinforcement of a traditional family dynamic, not just for Ripley, obviously, who finds a family with Hicks and Newts that becomes like a stereotypical nuclear family, but also with the alien queen itself. Obviously, Scott's original film was a lot more ambiguous about how the alien reproduced. The director's cut makes it clear that it reproduces in a way that's completely alien, if you will. But what Cameron does is he imposes a gendered norm upon it. And I admire that in a way, because, and it's not a direct rejection, because if it was just Ripley gets a family and that's fantastic, that would be problematic. But it's Ripley gets a family and the alien gets a family, and let's play the two of them off each other, which is much more interesting, I think.
But I think what my problem is that it sort of reinforces the dynamic, like you say, that Alien rejected, and that's much less interesting to me. I mean, it's really interesting to consider the film side by side, as you say, that, you know, one does this thing and the other rejects it, and they could form completely different franchises, essentially, and in a way they have.
Well, I mean, that's the irony, is that, like, is it Blomkamp at one stage was thinking about doing a sequel to Aliens and just ignoring everything else? Like, you could do that with the Alien franchise, which you can't do with modern franchises, which I kind of miss a little bit.
But Aliens ends up, I think, at a point it has a potential to be quite subversive in the way that it has, you know, really terrible character names, but at a point it has this capitalistic man who literally tries
Paul Reiser.
He literally tries to get her impregnated and to use her as a vessel to further his own financial aims. And it sort of rejects him as the bad guy and just goes with another mother, which has its own sort of interesting things, but I don't think it's quite as you know, this is very much my own take of what I would be interested in seeing play out thematically. And then you fall back for me on James Cameron's action, which is fine by 80s action standards, but it's not something I'm too into, so I've never really gone along with the film too much as a result.
Interesting enough, I've always seen Burke as fitting with Cameron's sort of Cameron interest in capitalism, obviously with Avatar. Let's not go down that road with Unobtainium and stuff. But like Cameron is arguably just as interested in capitalism as Scott is, but Scott sees capitalism as much more evil and effective, whereas Cameron tends to see it as bumbling and ineffective, but no less harmful for that fact.
Yeah.
So Burke concocts this horrific plan and then gets horrifically humiliated, whereas Scott's kind of corporate overlords literally tower over their establishments inside pyramids, staring down on mankind and, you know, not even bothering to weep playing chess. But yeah, so I again,
everyone gets killed by aliens because they don't have a union.
Yeah, that's pretty much. Yeah,
but I'm not a fan of Aliens, as I may have mentioned on occasion. It's been years since I've seen it. I was half tempted to go and see the 70mm screen, but then I was like, who am I fucking kidding? I'm not going to like it.
There are certain things you know you won't shift on.
It's a perfect Reagan era sequel in every sense, like. Mm. And it's gung-ho in a way that's, I don't think is ironic. I don't think it's in any way, shape, or form. It feels very fitting for the era that it's in.
I think it's smarter than you're giving it credit.
I don't think it is. No, it's not. Not for me, it's not. Right. I don't think Cameron's that subtle. I don't think he's that smart.
Oh, he's not subtle.
I think
he's smarter than you give him credit for, and that he's capable and he's competent and he knows what he's doing.
I give him credit just about for being competent, but that's fine. But I'm no fan of T2 either, which is also gets
you
me into trouble.
I think Terminator is much better.
Terminator is much better, but like Terminator is only best film. Like it's only good film in real terms. Like Cameron's. This is how we end.
Let's not fall down that
right. Let's leave it alone. But I'm not a fan. So yeah, sorry, Grace.
What else did I see? Oh, I saw Invasion of the Body Snatchers. On the
Which version?
The 70s version.
Oh, yeah, the Alien Invasion one with IFI.
The Sundance memes.
It is, yeah, isn't it?
It's good.
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah, that ending that's been parodied, you forget that. It's actually really weird when you watch the film.
Yeah.
It's quite horrifying.
Yeah.
The opening shots, you get that real close-up cinematography that literally goes to this granular detail about these things that are, you know, doing these horrible, horrible things to us soon. And the way it blows that up into a wider vision of society and the idea of not recognizing the people around you and how could they possibly be doing these things and believing these things. It's really fascinating. Yeah. I had a lot of fun with it. And I can't believe it.
Philip Kaufman, isn't it?
Yeah.
Filmmaker. Really interesting filmmaker.
Stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
The other one of his I saw not so long ago on 70 at the IFI as well.
Almost bankrupt the studio that made it, if I remember correctly. Their next release was Braveheart, wasn't it?
Saved it.
Wow.
The thing about that version of it, always find that it fit hand in hand at Double Wheel with They Live as a kind of American societal kind of watch.
Yeah. 70s and 80s.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Variations. Like, yeah, it'd be really interesting.
The 70s is a lot more somber.
Very much.
The 80s as well, at least we can get coked up.
Yeah, but the 70s, even that version, like we're 78, so we're moving away almost. We're drifting away from
From the wake of Watergate.
Yeah.
You know, the one-parent families, the latchkey kids, the breakdown of what we deem to be society.
I'm moving towards Top Gun.
The Jay's pinnacle of cinema.
Yes.
That's the pyramid atop which Jay stands.
Indeed it is.
And just one other thing I'll mention quickly, The Knights of Zayan Darud, Iranian film from 1990 by Mohsen Makhmalbaf, who you may remember as the director cast as himself in Kiarostami's Close-Up, if you've seen that one.
I haven't seen Close-Up.
Oh, Close-Up is magnificent.
I know, I've a list of Kiarostami's because I have to watch, that's, you know.
Just, I'm the same, I have so many of those catch-up lists, and every now and then I see one and go, wow, we really lost a lot there. Close-Up is magnificent. It's one of my favourite films. But this film, Knights of Zayan Darud, made in 1990, and it's shot in three sections before, during, and after the revolution in Iran, 79. And it's really, really fascinating. It was cut to ribbons. It's originally 100 minutes long. They cut about 35 minutes out, and the surviving 65 minutes were recovered from the censor's office at some point in the last couple decades. They are, even though 65 minutes are quite heavily censored, a lot of points there's no audio, and it just says down the bottom, you know, no audio due to censorship. But it's one of those remarkable things where you watch and you think, if they left this in, what did they cut?
There are some really
extremely critical things. It's beautifully shot, and it's got, you know, a lot of close-ups on wearied, broken faces at every point, I think, in this story, which shows almost a sense of frustration with the inertia of Iranian society, that despite all these, you know, the promise of revolution and the realization that it isn't going to bring the fulfillment you wanted, that there is a sort of stasis ingrained, whether religion is involved or not. Really, really impressive. And it's something that, it's a movie one, and I don't think it's expired yet. There are a couple of days for people to catch it.
Has a movie died in the last week?
Yeah, a movie's had a rough week, hasn't it? That was...
Imperial Filmstruck is sticking the boot in.
Yeah, they really are.
Yeah.
Pinning tweets with hashtags. That, I'm a really big fan of movie, but that was a really stupid move.
This is the infamous advertisement.
Yeah, advertising campaign that's just...
wrote Swan Lake.
Pure snobbery.
Which is...
And it's,
how does that appeal? Surely...
If it's a joke, who's going to get
but
it?
But
if you get the joke, you may be on movie.
Yeah,
if you don't get the joke...
But, like, that's not what advertising's purpose is.
In fairness, they did apologise and whatever, like, and that's fair enough.
Yeah, they said we got it wrong.
It did hurt, though.
Boy, they got it wrong.
They did.
How many levels of, like, yes did that have to be?
I couldn't even imagine.
It's one of those things like Book of Henry, where you imagine all it would have taken is one person to say no to stop this from happening.
Yeah.
But the tragedy of it is that it's not just that one poster. There are so many iterations.
What?
And you know... Oh, yeah.
I've only seen the Tarkovsky one.
Oh, there are a huge...
Did he put a load out, did he?
Yeah.
Oh, wow, they went all in.
I can't remember the other ones, but I thought somebody had made them up as a joke.
You
can't pronounce... Maybe that is the case.
Please don't say
but
that.
They look like genuine pictures of these things. There are a lot of these really snobby things.
Yeah. And on, like, subway stations over in the States, in, like, places where people will actually see them. Yeah.
It's really not good.
Sorry, but we're not here to bury them. We're here to praise them.
I'm still a subscriber. I'll stick with them.
I had Mubi for a year, and I really liked it, but I didn't use it enough to kind of justify a renewal. Yeah. But that's kind of hurt this week. But it is a great service. There's films you will not see anywhere else.
Yeah.
And whatever about anything else, that's important.
That's the thing.
They only have 30 titles on the line, so you have one
each day, one taken away. Yeah. And it's great they give access to this kind of thing, a film that, you know, otherwise I think
I would not have
had the opportunity to see.
If there's films like that, particularly in, like, stuff in the festival circuit that don't get any kind of distribution and stuff like that, it's very, very good for things.
And they're particularly good for releasing things that have been to festivals and will never get a release here.
Yeah. No, in fairness, despite the bad week they've had, it is a really good service.
As much as they've done a lot to tarnish their name, they provide a very good service.
Perfect. All right, so my own week, bunch of very, very popular stuff as usual. Darren playing purely to form. Watch a couple of Darren's favorite movies, favorite director duologies.
God.
So I rewatched The Social Network, which was great. It was on TV a couple of weeks
ago. Actually, I rewatched it as well.
It's rotating
about a week and a half ago.
Yeah, that's it. It's rotating through the channel. So it was one of those, stumbled on TV, it was on. So I found my DVD and watched it from the beginning. as ever, brilliant film, fantastic, has aged remarkably well. And not just in the way that you would think, in terms of obviously Facebook being in the news, Zuckerberg being a public figure, and now memeable, however you pronounce that now at the moment, but also in terms of understanding something about the technological revolution that I don't think a lot of people did in the context of 2010 when it was released, or even 2004, 2003 when it was actually happening, which is just how much of this is anchored in the fact that these men really, really hate women. And rewatching it, that's what really took me back. The wonderful, not, I don't say wonderful inverted commas, but the wonderful way that Fincher and Sorkin illustrate how interwoven the development of this network and technology is with this sort of strain of misogyny that runs through it, and the juxtaposition that runs throughout it, where you have this coding, this sort of new digital frontier, this reclaiming of or sculpting of a digital landscape juxtaposed with more traditional forms of misogyny that people will recognize, the women being rounded up to be taken on the frat bus, that sort of stuff like that, and sort of playing
which is there as well, but it's not, it's obviously almost handing over to the kind of digital version of that.
It's juxtaposed against each other. It's done remarkably well. It's aged phenomenally.
It's extremely clean film. Like, it's so well, like, wherever Sorkin can be wordy and whatever, but Fincher is a great director for his words, because he knows just how to use them. And he edits down, I suspect, probably a lot of speeches and stuff in it.
It's 2 hours long, which is remarkable given the amount of content, to use the Facebook term, that it manages to squeeze in there.
No, I agree. I think it's aged superbly. Fincher's a really interesting director, because a lot of the films, weirdly don't get the credit or due when they come out, but tend to age better than a lot of other filmmakers that do get an initial kind of bump.
The Social Network is probably the exception, because The Social Network was roundly praised when it was released. I remember there being a big discussion in 2006.
It's other films, I suppose, more than that. But I think its stature's only risen, is what I suppose we're getting at. And I think a few of his other films are similar.
Oh, don't worry, I'm going to move on to one of those next.
Oh, okay.
The following evening, I happened to be lounging around about 10 o'clock at night, and so I decided I'd stick on The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. I'd continue my segue and my work through David Fincher's filmography. First thing I discovered seeing it on 10 o'clock on Sunday night, it is 2 hours and 48 minutes.
It's a really long film.
It is
for a film that's based on a novel that really can't sustain that length.
But it's... I think it's deeply flawed. I think it's far too long. I think it has a great deal of pacing issues, mostly related to the fact that it keeps its two leads separated for an hour and 20 minutes of its runtime, which isn't, you know, a choice you can defend theoretically, but when you're watching the film, it doesn't always work as well as it could.
I'm okay mostly with that. I actually really like the film.
No, I like it a lot.
I've watched it about three times, I think, and it's improved each viewing.
Yeah. Part of what's striking about it for me, and particularly on rewatch, is just how utterly uninterested Fincher is in the actual plot, the killing of women. He's completely, like, the reason the film is as long as it is because he spends an hour and 20 minutes getting to the meat of the plot, and he spends 40 minutes afterwards exploring what the characters do after the plot is resolved. There's, like, I happen to be browsing the script, and you talk about editing stuff down, this is a 2 hour 48 minute movie. You imagine not a lot was ended, but if you look at the script and see what was cut, it's all the serial killer stuff. Fincher was just completely disinterested. This whole big motive ran from Stellan Skarsgård and stuff like that. So what you have instead is this more abstract sort of, like, and it's interesting because it plays surprisingly well as a companion piece to The Social Network, not only through the casting of Rooney Mara. Rooney Mara obviously playing Erica,
famously in the start, the opening sequence of
The Social Network. So in The Social Network, she's presented almost as the first victim of the digital age. And then in The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, Rudy Mara is playing this character who is almost a native of the digital frontier at a time when this colonization is taking place, because the film is set in 2003-2004,
and she is on the high end of the kind of internet and finding information, all that kind of stuff, and grabbing information
and pulling it back, and also dealing with misogyny obviously in the real world and that sort of stuff as well. And it's remarkable because it plays, like, one of the interesting things about watching a good director, particularly a director like Fincher, doing a film like this is, and you say the Fincher films don't always get the credit that they deserve. Fincher's films can be broken down into, like, for example, the big four, which are, you know, Fight Club, Seven, The Social Network, and Zodiac, which are the ones that are regarded as the classic, the canon. These are the films that we'll be talking about when we're talking about the best films of the past 25 years.
We won't be talking about Fight Club in that way, but I take your point.
No, okay. When
it's the only one that's probably aged badly.
Important.
I agree.
Great in the way that Oliver Cromwell is a great man.
Yes, okay.
Oh,
okay. Good lord. Okay, yes, okay.
You went for the nuclear option.
You took the hammer on me. Okay, go on.
But yeah, And then on the other hand, you have Fincher sort of doing more genre stuff, more traditional stuff. Obviously, the Alien 3, the game, Panic Room, stuff like that. And this is interesting because this is a later example of that after he's done all the prestige stuff. But when you strip that stuff out, you get pure form. Because like it's very much as a standard serial killer, prestige serial killer format. It's about men who hate women. The novel it's based on is literally translated as
Men Who Hate Women.
But it's done with such style and such grace. And it's also incredibly playful. The $13 million opening credit sequence, which cost more than the Swedish film on which it was based, and ate up more than 10% of the film's budget. The fact that he cast Daniel Craig in what is effectively the role of a Bond girl. It's hilarious. When you watch the film knowing that Craig has been cast to play off his persona as a Bond girl, he's the nice bit of totty.
Yeah.
There's a moment where Lisbeth Salander is sitting there tapping on the computer doing the hard work. He comes out of the shower in a dressing gown and cuddles up behind her for warmth. It's absolutely beautiful. He gets like tied up by Stellan Sarsgaard, sort of victimized, and she comes in with a golf club. Yeah. It's very playful, it's very
knowing. I agree with you. Like, I mean, the only issue I have with the film, but one I've got less and less as time goes on, as you said, is the kind of the post bit at the end where it just kind of just keeps going and going and going. And you're like, why are we still here? But I've even learned to kind of grudgingly admire that. Yeah, exactly. I think it's it's miles better than what it's based
Swedish
on. Like,
and the novel.
And Runemara is magnificent. Like, they make great work out of something that's trash, essentially.
I am really disappointed that this didn't turn into a sequel, into a franchise.
But it's going to turn into a sequel, but not Fincher,
which
sequel.
Which is disappointing.
I know,
and not Mara as well. They're doing
the girl...
Yes, Claire Foy, but what's it called?
The Girl with the Spider's Web, which is about four books along. It's a new writer because this guy's taken over the franchise, essentially, for the family and put it in the state. I think it's a really interesting film. It's one of those films that when I saw in the cinema, I didn't particularly enjoy it. I rewatched it and I was like, that's not bad. And then I found myself wanting to rewatch it again, you know, and it has a certain thing that I really like.
And it was basically David Fincher sort of Pringle moment. It was like, once I popped, I just can't stop.
Yeah.
I'll be going to Gone Girl.
I know I have that with Zodiac, I have to say, because I've watched Zodiac about six or seven
Zodiac
times.
Zodiac is really great.
Which I think is his absolute masterpiece and one of the best films this century.
Speaking of one of the best films this century, I also rewatched two Christopher Nolan films. So I rewatched Dunkirk, which is still fantastic.
How many times have you seen Dunkirk?
At this stage, I think we're crossing 11, maybe 12.
More times than I've seen all of Christopher Nolan's films combined.
But it is still fantastic. Wonderful humanist fairy tale about empathy and compassion. And the idea that when people are, you know, that you don't need to know a person's history, backstory, or identity in order to feel an emotional connection. You just need to feel them suffer. And in theory, that should be enough for you to forge a connection to them based on that. But which is a remarkable humanist idea.
The fact that the film is really short is good.
Okay. And I also watched, for its 10th anniversary, The Dark Knight, screening in 35mm at the Lighthouse. Which is phenomenal. The best blockbuster of the past 20 years, I would argue.
We'll talk about that in the top 10.
Oh,
it's on.
Sir.
Defiance now.
All right, fine.
I do like
Gauntlet Throne.
I mentioned to you earlier in the week that The Dark Knight is my favorite Christopher Nolan film. I like it a lot.
Yep, you don't have to make excuses, John.
I'm not making excuses. I'm saying I'm with you on this one. I think it's really good.
Memento. But yeah, I really like The Dark Knight. It's probably second.
All right, well, before we can get to the top 10, let's talk about the week in film news.
Hit me.
The big film news of the week, internationally speaking, is that Mowgli, Andy Serkis's Jungle Book film, produced at Warner Brothers, is going direct to Netflix.
This was a bad idea from the get-go, right? In terms of the competing...
Well, to be fair...
Probably at the very get-go, I haven't seen that quite as bad.
I was going to say, like, one imagines that, like, when they were green-lighting it, it wasn't like Disney's doing it as well. It was like, okay, we're kind of committed now.
Yeah.
Because there was an arms race to get them into cinemas at the same time, but...
But it's...
Didn't work.
No.
And then they pushed it back, but it turned out Disney were releasing a sequel to The Jungle Book, and they're like, okay, this is not working at all.
Awkward.
Disney have taken it and ruined all their kind of properties, so Yeah,
but this is a little... It's interesting because it'll be a huge blockbuster on Netflix.
What's the budget of it?
The budget was...
I think it's pretty solid. Like,
Like 130 million-ish. I think
are we approaching, like, it's going to de-seat Marty as the most...
No, I don't think so. That's probably still adding tens
Marty's
of millions as we speak. He's spending
he's
Netflix dollar.
Ten.
No,
Netflix Mr. Serendos, can I have another million? Billion? I say give it to him. Give him all the money.
That's a part of me that's kind of looking forward to the Irishman in that regard.
It's like
$200 million.
It's like New York again. He's going to nearly bankrupt
and
the studio.
They don't get any games in New York.
They don't have
He's
a...
good at this.
There is no budget. They've actually been... oh!
They've erased it. They don't want you to know.
The accountants have got rid of it.
Yep, they've been. They've kept it quite close to the ground, apparently. They're playing it very close to the chest.
No
but
doubt.
Yeah, it, one imagines we're talking, anyway, well over $100 million, which is... Yikes. I mean, if the Irishman is in at $140 million.
I suspect the Irishman will top out near the $200 million. But,
when you factor in publicity and stuff. But yeah, new age of Netflix, really, which is astounding. And he's doing Animal Farm for them as well, off the back of this as well.
Circuses,
which is good. So he's doing a...
Doing for Netflix.
For Netflix.
Yeah, we'll see. Is it going to be animated?
What? Well, it's going to be computer-generated as well.
Oh, no, I mean, is it the Animal Farm going to be...
Computer-generated, I would have
So it's not... Like, it's going to be a live action.
Yeah. That's when you say live action...
Yeah, the CGI, that's a bad idea.
I mean, you know...
That's a really bad idea. Like,
it's also a very short book.
Yeah, it's like 100 pages.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to adding in backstory for all of these characters.
What I look forward to is when 2 weeks from now.
Beauty and the Beast with the recent remake of Beauty and the Beast, which gave us the much needed backstory for Belle's mother. In order to extend. Well, they had to add 40. They had to add 40 minutes somewhere, Ronan.
Why? The original is. The cartoon version is like 90 minutes.
Yeah, I know. They had to add 40 minutes somewhere.
Yeah, fair enough.
But you know what's going to happen there? 3 weeks from now, we're going to get a press release saying. Animal Farm is now a TV series of 13 episodes and then we're going to watch it and wonder why episodes 4 to 9 are even there because the whole story is going to be covered in, and then they'll announce a follow up season where they're going to write their own Animal Farm follow up. You know it's going to happen.
Well, I mean that would be the opposite of what happened with, was it the Ballad of Billy Scruggs?
Buster Scruggs.
Buster Scruggs.
So they just decided to do a film. Netflix will just give you money for anything, won't they?
They will.
Let's knock up a script, lads. They'll give you 100 million.
You say that like it's like, okay, what? All Netflix, CBS do. Netflix release a lot of crap. No, absolutely no qualification here. No sort of like, no attempted defense here. But on the other hand, if you have a studio in town that when Marty or the Coens come up with
I
have no problem with
that. Some of the stories I find befuddling there, but I suppose if you're juggling like 700 things over a year, this is.
The idea is that we are here for the Marty and Coens. There are people who are here for season 3 of Daredevil. It's
I'm waiting for season 2 of Mindhunter. Anyway, well.
But yeah, speaking of Fincher.
Yeah, indeed.
But yeah, so in terms of other news, the Orson Welles season is playing at the IFI. Which is an interesting choice. It's there, I think, to celebrate Mark Cousins is coming there with his documentaries.
Yeah, he's here for a Q&A session with Donald Clark on I think the 22nd of this month. It's an interesting season. I think Jay, you made the point that it's starting to get really frustrating that it's always the same.
Yeah, I just like they're all great films, and it does sound a little kind of a little pissy to be complaining about.
I think the same four
Orson Welles ones, but I wouldn't mind seeing.
And like Battleship Potemkin on the big screen.
No, I mean Niles made the point that the documentary, which he's seen, the Cousins documentary, and really like gets heavily into the Shakespearean Welles. So I think if you're going to do a season around it, maybe those films might have maybe made an appearance or two. Yeah. But, I mean, maybe there's reasons around that. I mean, that's absolutely fine.
It would be nice to see it a bit broader, because it's you know, I think the season has 8 to 10 films, and is it three well-directed ones there? Citizen Kane, Ambersons, and Touch of Evil. I don't think there's any other Wells-directed ones there. Which is nice to talk in terms of influence and...
Let's run through the nine. So the nine are Battleship Potemkin, City Lights, Stagecoach... Then you get the three Orson Welles ones, Citizen Kane, Magnificent Ambersons, Touch of Evil. Then you're into Kubrick with The Killing, There Will Be Blood, and The Stories We Tell. It does seem very much like it's an excuse to show these films, which people love. And to be honest, seeing There Will Be Blood or The Killing or Battleship Potemkin on the big screen, any excuse to do it.
I love There Will Be Blood, but there's never not a year that you can't see that on the big screen.
That's the thing.
You know, it's that kind of thing. And that's fine. Like, it's a great film, but... You're never short of opportunities because next year somebody else will be showing it.
There will be blood screened here on 35 in twice Lighthouse. In February.
Yeah, and I saw it's it.
Not long gone.
And I saw when it came out and when it released. I mean, it's fine. It's great. And
it's a great film.
Fire fantastic and stuff. But like, it just it feels like a little bit of a missed opportunity. So.
In other news, the Still Voices Short Film Festival takes place in Ballymahon from August 16th through 19th, which is basically it's in Longford.
I was going to ask because I'm in Dublin, I have no idea where Ballymahon.
But yeah, they're using four venues: so the Bog Lane Theatre, the Library, Cooney's Hotel, and Skelly's Bar. They'll be screening over 100 short films, national and international feature films, documentaries, QAs, excitement panels, and just a wonderful range of material. Excellent. Almost 500 short films from 53 countries were submitted. Submitted this year, with 100 selected for in competition and 24 screening out of competition. So they'll be playing basically 24 programs from Friday morning until Sunday evening. So if you are in the area, it's well worth a look. I know they're also screening a couple of features. So for example, they're showing The Farthest, which is fantastic. Yeah, if you haven't seen it, it's an amazing documentary.
I still haven't actually. I missed the big screen opportunity. Good. It feels like I need to see it on the big screen, you know.
And they're also showing Twilight by Pat Collins, which I believe was screened at ADIF this year. I think Jay may have seen that, actually.
I didn't.
That was in the midst of the terrible snow.
Oh,
yeah,
the blizzard.
I did miss it, unfortunately, yeah, because it was shown before Paul Vann's film.
So that was a double.
I've seen that, but I haven't seen it in the big screen, unfortunately.
I caught Twilight. It's really, really good. Well worth seeing. I trudged through the snow, and it was worth every single squelchy footstep.
Yeah. I remember that evening. That was where I saw the double bill of Isle of Dogs and Red Sparrow. One of those films was worth it.
Oh, no.
And Mary and the Witch's Flower is also showing as well for family-friendly audiences.
That's been popping up a lot, actually. It's been a lot of good business around the country.
It is. It was the first one that showed after the blizzard at ADIF, I believe, as well. And it also popped up on the Japanese Film Festival.
Yeah.
And it's getting rave reviews. People
also, it's on other Netflixes, which I'm very much looking forward to catching it on.
It's got to be a better plural.
Netflix. Join us next week when we put a poll together for
Netflods. But anyway, in other news, the Galway Film Centre has set a Fish TV summit for basically November 2018. It's really weird saying Fish instead of the Irish Film Board. I still haven't quite gotten used to that.
Me neither. Then I haven't really said any of them, so yeah.
But yeah, there'll be interviews there with Graham Lenehan and a panel of the Director Generals.
Will there?
Of the main broadcast.
Where are my eggs?
Another Galway road trip.
And another with funders from the world of video on demand. We'll also see the launch of the $2 million Western Regional Audiovisual Producers or RAP Fund as well, which I think we talked about in the podcast before.
Very good. It's great. Very good, bar one particular part.
There was a lot of great Connect content at the FLA, so it's great to see more funding going into that.
Sure. Yeah, and it is right. We've been covering in the news here, there's been a lot of investment there. There's a lot of programs there as well towards getting writers in residence, towards encouraging filmmakers down that sort of end of the country.
Oh, good stuff.
And it is beautiful. As somebody from that part of the country, it's an astonishingly beautiful landscape, and it's got its own stories to tell. Without any further ado, let's move on to tell you about the top 10.
Woo-hoo.
At number 10, Thomas and Friends, Big World, Big Adventures, the movie.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
I got nothing. This snuck into the top 10. I have no idea what it's doing there.
Something that sort of took me by surprise. This was there last week as well. It is a bit of a surprise. They've been releasing one a year since 2008.
Have they now?
Yep. And I'm always surprised when I go and see the Pixar film, and I go and see it in the cinema, and they show an ad for it, and it's not the same movie, although it looks like the same movie, but it's not, apparently.
Okay.
At number 9, holding very, very well, Hotel Artemis, which I remain... I'm quite impressed. It's earned $68,000 to date. I really want to see this. I haven't been able to find time because I've been so busy rewatching movies that I've already seen.
Maybe instead of watching Dunkirk for the 12th time, Darren, you might catch this.
Oh yeah, I went there.
Right. It looks like a lot of fun. I really like the look of how much fun Jodie Foster seems to be having.
And Jeff Goldblum. I mean, the cast is astounding. Yeah, it's hard to imagine Jeff Goldblum ever phoning it in. I mean, what would Jeff Goldblum phoning it in even sound like?
Have you seen Le Weekend? Anytime somebody talks to Jeff Goldblum, I just
Jim
think
Broadbent
of him
and
like shouting down the stairs.
I really like that. I love you. I think you recommended it to me, actually.
I
really
like
it.
It's like a seventh before film.
I did a remake.
At number 8, appropriately enough, it's Ocean's 8, which is great.
Which has been around for a long time.
€1.1 million at the Irish box office. We talked about this last week, but this is a movie that has really benefited from the big berth that was given for the World Cup. Yeah. It was allowed to run, and it was allowed to go, and it's had to garner good word of mouth. Like, I mean, even I, who am not a huge fan of it, who have some qualms with it. I think it's great fun. I think it's highly enjoyable. I think it's very hard to leave the cinema without a smile on your face.
Yeah.
And if that's the harshest criticism you're getting,
that's not bad.
That's not bad at all. At number 7, Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom.
Speaking of not leaving the top 10, good lord.
3.2 million euro today.
Not my euros.
Yeah. Again, another monster. This opened before the World Cup to give us sort of like a sense of scale.
Yeah.
There are movies that were released at the same time that are now available on home video. Mm-hmm. This is
well, we all know the World Cup started about 7 years ago and lasted 6 of those.
At number 6. Yeah, at number 6.
I'm not getting involved in this. I'm not.
Skyscraper, which is holding on remarkably well given its somewhat rather underwhelming debut
but
and
done okay
performance
here.
Worldwide. Yeah, it's done okay. Half a million euros to date.
Okay.
So Dwayne Johnson may not be quite dead in the water yet. But yeah, it is a sort of a bit of a blow to the idea of Johnson as our generation's movie star.
No, it's one film. It's fine. He's been doing well overall. I am not ditching Johnson just yet. He's great fun.
I like Johnson too.
Yeah,
I'm a big fan.
He's still a big pull with the question.
Do you know, Darren?
Deep in my heart. I never doubted him.
I think he's
him.
Terrific like that.
No, he's charismatic, he's charming, and he can really sell, I just want to know what's happening to my friend who is a giant CGI ape. There are a few actors who can do that. Johnson can. There's a purity to him. At number 5, Andre Rieu's 2008 Maastricht Concert Amore.
Oh, for fuck's sake.
Event Cinema. Again, Jay Cinema Experience.
I was over in Maastricht in February for a work thing, and this guy... I feel like he owns the town. Like he's like,
it's the biggest square in Luxembourg.
He's,
right?
He's the worst person in the world.
What?
And it's not the worst. He's fine. He's fine. Wait, he's fine.
He's talking about
no, sorry. It's inexplicably popular. I don't know what to say. It's
But I mean, this is the kind of thing. We talked about this before, where these events seem to sneak in. I mean,
I'm not going to see Andre Rieu at an event cinema. I'm just going to point that out. Jay's cinema experience has limits.
Why would you think that I would push? Yeah, why would you think I would? Because
you're
this?
Darren, and I know you.
That's very fair. You are Darren, and he does know you.
That's it.
You make me sound like some sort of like crypt keeper of
Svengali
sort of like,
figure.
Well, yeah, what
Rasputin over there?
What sort of horrible experience do I have in store for Jay this weekend?
That sounds accurate.
I feel like we need to get to the stage where I just tell you to show up at a cinema at a time, no questions asked.
No idea what you're
saying. We'll see about that.
At number 4, it's Incredibles 2, earning 2.9 million euros to date. This is going to run and run. This is going to be one of the films of the summer. Again, it's family-friendly. It's got that Pixar sheen to it. The Lighthouse are currently running their own Pixar season. They're hosting a dog-friendly or dog-friendly screening of Up.
I don't like dog-friendly screenings. I don't like dogs
in cinemas.
You
don't have a dog.
That's hardly the reason there. It's unhygienic in a cinema.
Are you ever going to be in the cinema with them?
I don't like it. I might be in the cinema after them.
I feel like I'm okay
theoretically with it, but the practicality of it just make me feel a bit weird.
I'm very into it for all the pictures that I get to look
at.
The pictures are good. They are adorable, aren't they?
And they're such good boys.
Yeah. 12 out of 10.
Squirrel. But yeah, so the Incredibles 2, great fun. Fantastic. Some of the best action scenes of the summer. Probably the second best action movie of the summer so far. And I suspect When the Dust Settles probably will be the second best action movie of the summer. At number 3, Hotel Transylvania 3, A Monster Vacation.
These do okay, don't they?
These do okay. Nearly half a million euros.
Animation,
on its opening
man.
Weekend. Yeah, gotta take the kids to something. Summer's still going. School ain't in session.
Who doesn't love Adam Sandler?
Yeah. Kids who aren't young enough to know better. I'm looking forward to your trip through the Adam Sandler Netflix.
Me too. I can't wait to start.
Shouldn't there be more of those by now? Has he only done one of them?
He's done a whole set of them.
There's
plenty. People just stopped looking at the car crash. Yeah, okay. After 4 or 5 started piling on them. I was reading a wonderful list on Vulture of the worst Netflix films that are available on Netflix. You would be surprised how many of them star Adam Sandler.
Yeah. I wouldn't be. I actually wouldn't be.
But yeah, apparently Hotel Transylvania is very charming.
Yeah, I quite like the first one. I haven't seen the second one, but I can imagine that'd be okay.
I didn't see the first one. I saw the second one. Second one had this nice sort of like... sort of Tex Avery animation quality.
The first one I like, they're nice. I like.
Well, I mean, it's Wendy Tarkovsky, yeah. So he's got that sort of, he is very much an animator's animator.
Yeah,
so you get the bodies moving in particular ways. You get more
okay,
of a fight gag. It's
just, he pretty much saved the first film. Like, he came in and kind of.
Yeah, he
at a certain point
and
fixed it basically, and he's rolled his ticket.
He did what Brad Bird did on Rotten too.
Yeah,
I've seen some of his live action stuff, and it wasn't good.
He did live action stuff.
I think so. I may be thinking of someone else entirely.
But
he did
Samurai
Jack is
probably
what he's most famous for,
which is incredible.
He also has done some work in comics as well, because he's primarily
Wars.
Like
he
an illustrator.
Clone Wars stuff
he did the Clone Wars animated shorts, I believe, but not the TV show. At number two. Your mission, should you choose to accept it, and apparently a lot of people did, Mission Impossible Fallout.
I haven't seen it yet. I did watch
Rogue Nation,
which is on my catch-up list, which I wasn't a massive fan of either. I suspect they're not. The Mission Impossible ones aren't bingeable in the way that other films may be.
They're each distinct from one another in that they don't blend into one another when you watch them. When you're watching them, it's very easy to tell from a scene which Mission Impossible film you're watching.
I don't,
and not because not because of characters or plot, but just because of the different characters.
I don't know. Rogue Wave Nation was okay, but you know, Rebecca Ferguson's the best thing in it. I would like to see her get a spin-off, maybe.
Well,
but
she's back in
Rogue. So I heard.
That's her back in Fallout.
Yeah, she's been on that opera sequence is tremendous.
Well, the opera sequence is fantastic. It's a great excuse never to watch Quantum Solace ever again.
Yeah, yeah. That's the best thing in the film by some distance.
Well, I mean,
I'm kind of bored after that, but you know, it's fine.
Really, not the dive underwater, backwards car chase, upside down motorbike
but
riding.
But the same as every other film type thing. At least the opera sequence had elegance and a bit of craft to it, where the rest are just Mission Impossible action sequences.
The opera sequence, it's very much the opera sequence is Macquarie channeling first director De Palma. The later sequence is him channeling Bird. He's doing the buffet option.
It kind of irritates me a little bit though, because one thing he might be better at one thing rather than others though. You know that kind of way.
All right.
You know, I like McCarthy's director, but he's no De Palma. You know,
he's certainly not De Palma. Jack Reacher,
and that's
terrible.
All I'll say. Like, you know, and it, like and anyway.
But yeah,
I know I'm pushing against the tide here. Most people, when you get to 4 and 5 on these things, people love them, and I feel like I'm some sort
of
asshole
fighting
for John Woo films.
Jay, you don't ever have to apologize for being you.
Thank you, Dar. Thank you.
But yeah, Mission Impossible Fallout, film of the summer so far.
I'll be seeing it the weekend, so next week I'll be here to tell you all about my opinions.
Speaking, that sounds ominously like a threat.
Yes.
Speaking of the film of the summer,
number
one.
Oh yes,
holding on for a second week
of 20.
Here we go again. It's Mamma Mia. Here we go again. I really shouldn't have opened with that segue.
Yeah.
But yes, €2.3 million to date. A monster,
you know,
of a film.
They can't dance, they can't jive, but I did have the time of my life. It's great.
It's fantastic.
It's so good. I saw it for a second time last night, and I'll happily go back for a third.
Well, counterpoint, it's very good.
Oh, dear.
But it misses Streep. Like, it is, I think you're entirely correct. We talked about this a little bit off mic, where, like, it is directed, which is the best thing that it has
directed.
Over the previous.
Not just directed well, it's directed.
No,
that's all you need to say.
It is directed well, though.
It is wonderfully directed.
Oh,
it's got these wonderful scene transitions that seamlessly edited together. Like, there are some wonderful cuts, juxtapositions, camera movements. It's very well made. It's wonderfully well put together. There's a lot of fun. It does have a Streep-shaped absence at its core.
I think it's okay, though. I think he gets away with it. I think when they do bring her into it slightly, they do wonderful things with it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Lily James more than makes up for the character's loss. I think she's incredible.
Lily James
is
great.
I think the fascinating thing about what Lily James is doing, unlike any of her three suitors, is that she's not aping her older counterpart. They all do impressions. I don't think she does.
Okay.
I think she really brings her own sense to the character in a way that doesn't make the character feel disjointed from what
she
was.
She feels like
a
younger version of somebody in the way... Somebody
that you develop
in
the same way that you're undeveloped.
I suppose that you wouldn't be
you wouldn't have the mannerisms.
The exact kind of thing of somebody that's...
I would argue that two of the three suitors do bad in... Well,
no,
one
I,
of them
I,
not terrible.
I
two
agree.
Of them
I would argue
I
one of them, I would say, which is the Colin
young
Firth
Matt Smith,
one.
Yes. The Matt Smith, Tom Colin Firth character.
Yeah,
which is
that's
young
that's
any English actor except for
Colin
Firth.
Firth, yes.
I quite like the Pierce Brosnan one.
I think he gets a little annoying with the accent at times, but otherwise he's very dashing and charming, and he pulls it off. He really makes you believe the kind of romance that they're then playing off just by Brosnan by himself.
Yeah.
Singing
which
SOS.
Which is quite sad. Yeah,
which,
I know, yeah.
When he started, like, singing SOS, I was like, that's it? They've reclaimed the worst part of the original, where he's tunelessly belting it out, and now I can never rewatch the original. And I went back and rewatched the original. I no longer laugh at that, because they've, like, invested it with this tragic hindsight.
To be fair, like, again, and again, I really like the film. What it does really well is it acknowledges Brosnan's limitations. He's gone from being like... There was a sense when he was doing the first one that he was taking it relatively seriously. Now he's just having fun. There's a wonderful, like, shot of a bunch of extras who are obviously, like, trained dancers who've been doing this all their lives, moving in rhythm, and in the center of the shot it's Pierce Brosnan, and he's trying, damn it, but he's just going for it.
He keeps doing the most ridiculous move, you know, throwing his fingers in his hair and throwing his hair. He knows he can't dance a step, and he loves it, because he's had 10 years of people telling him this is the best thing he've ever done, and it probably is, and I like him a lot.
Me too.
He has so much fun.
Can I just say, I watched the first one again last night because I can't get enough of these, right?
Yeah.
But what's really interesting, one thing that stuck out for me really bizarrely, and I didn't notice it when I watched the second because I'd forgotten, even though I only watched the first one a few weeks ago, is that when you look at all the pictures of the young guys, right?
Because
you see the pictures. Yeah. Pierce Brosnan is like hair and a hippie and a beard and a kind of long moustache. It's like, they just ignore that.
They
like,
totally ignore that.
I was like, I have no issue with this.
Yeah,
like, it doesn't really matter, obviously. You know,
I mean, the internal continuity of the Mamma Mia franchise.
The two guys are similar, like they're broadly similar to what you'd expect.
Well, what's really interesting is that the kind of internal continuity of it, they pay a lot of attention. And, I watched the first one relatively soon after I watched the second one, since gone back and watched the second one again. And there is a lot of actually
awkwardly shifting things in to
make sure that they do fit in that way. They just completely ignore that part because they can do something much more interesting with it. And I think in doing that, they almost make... It's very, very seamless the way that they go from one plot strand to another, from prequel to sequel.
That's all Parker's direction. Like, this is the scene
really
transition.
Well. But the prequel stands alone in a very good way in that it's this really interesting story of... something that shouldn't be radical, but is radical in Hollywood these days, of allowing a woman sexual agency. And it's joyous in the way it does that. It's completely non-judgmental, as the original was. In the you know, it's got many, many different types of couples. And
that's exactly it. And I think what's really interesting about the second one is that you get this sense that these characters feel lived in a way, post-theater film, even though, you know... Like, you get the Christine Baranski and Julie Walters characters come back, and they're still as amazing as ever, but they are added a level of... Because you see the younger versions of them, who are fantastic.
Oh, the younger version of Christina Baranski
they're
fantastic.
Much better than the men.
Right, so, much, much better. Yeah. But you get the sense when you see the three of them doing the Donna and the Dynamo's kind of stuff when they're young. Adds such poignancy to the revisit of stuff that's really wonderful.
Personally waiting for the TV movie 6-episode edit like the Godfather's where they reorder it all chronologically.
I would watch the hell out of
the full Mamma Mia saga.
If we can have a couple extra songs thrown in, I'm all for it.
I like that. That's the scene that we throw in.
I'm not going to say anything spoilerific, I don't think, but there's this, at the end of the second film, there's a kind of a, I know, it's not a montage sequence, but there's a sequence pulls a lot of stuff together.
Yeah.
And somebody made a point on Twitter that they would be happy to see a third film exist within that, and also would I. It would be amazing to watch certain things happen a certain way in a bizarre netherworld that I'd be happy to watch, because there better be a third one, and a fourth, and a fifth.
Have you learned nothing?
How much they're making, there will be.
But I don't know where they're going to go, and I don't care.
The third one's going to have Andy Garcia assassinated by helicopter on the veranda of the hotel.
It's just so fantastic. Mexico, 1959.
That's
what we get this year. I know, it's a bizarre
movie.
It's in my top five of the year so far, ahead of Phantom Thread. Take that film, Twitter.
I have to say, I was looking at my list, and I haven't decided where to squeeze it in yet, but it's probably going to be in the top three. I just had so much fun with it. And I went back last night, went to see it in Cineworld with my housemates who hadn't been yet, and I had told them I was running a little late, but I said, don't worry, Cineworld has 30 minutes of ads. And then being Irish, they were then like, oh, should we have to show up for this time? And showed up a little while later. So we missed the first 10 minutes. And I was really annoyed because they've got two really great dance numbers in the first 2 minutes. Plus, Baranski gets the best line of the film.
Oh, yeah, that's a great show. Oh, it's amazing.
The one when Mr. Garcia first shows up,
It's amazing. Baranski can deliver the hell out of that stuff.
God, can't you? And that whole scene where they're talking to Garcia for the first time. And so annoyed was I with my housemates. You know, I was like, you cannot miss Celia Imrie singing in Scottish. that they went off and went into the first 10 minutes of the next screening to catch
it.
So
baby.
You cannot not have seen these scenes. Because actually, Kiss the Teacher is such a great dance number.
Yeah, it is.
Well.
It's a fantastic.
And like cycling over glass plates and things. Yeah. It's very much sort of like, we got a fancy team this time, guys. Look, everybody.
Production.
We hired a choreographer.
Yeah.
But I will say, just before we finish, after watching the first one last night, it's not as good as the sequel. But there's a ramshackle, weird wildness to it. I do miss, as slick as the second one is, the first one is all over. Like, it's a hair's breadth and falling apart. Like,
yeah.
But
yeah,
that's kind
time.
Of what it's
that's
lovely about it. It
yeah.
is.
Yeah, yeah.
And you do kind of miss that a little bit.
It's a
as
bit
beautifully, yeah, that was very naff. But that's fine. That's happens.
I mean, naff is not an yeah,
no, it's
not.
But it's not very well directed. But that's also fine. It's not very well performed a lot of the time. It's still fine. But that's also part of the charm.
Yeah. It feels as if they literally arrived on an island and said, we've got to make a film.
Yeah. Yeah, but it's great fun. Like, I mean,
it's
not for a second,
fun.
But
it's happily watch it again.
It's so ramshackle and all over the gaff, which is so charming.
And the second, it's an interesting tension between polishing that and potentially losing the charm of it.
Yeah.
And
they
don't at all. They polish it really well, and
it's
still so charming because you still get the self awareness of Pierce Brosnan being an absolute fool, falling around the place and loving it. And I admire him so much for just throwing himself into it. He has the best time,
but
and he repeatedly cracks
credits.
Up on screen, and they don't bother cutting
the closing
it
credit sequence with Pierce Brosnan. It's Pierce Brosnan living his best life.
Yeah,
he's
got
a pint in a plastic cup, wearing a jumpsuit, and just swaggering. Everybody else in that sequence looks like they're having a good time.
Pierce turned up 3 hours before everyone else and got going.
There are bits where you've got like Meryl throwing her arms around Cher. It's just like, yes. Be more. And that wonderful sequence where they get the younger and older versions of them and the way they interact is hilariously funny. Yeah, I'm going a third time, definitely.
I'm going next weekend.
Okay, so if you are not going to see Mamma Mia for a third time, the new releases this week include The Escape, directed by Dominic Savage, starring Gemma Arterton, Dominic Cooper, and Francis Barber. A very ominous plot description. An ordinary woman makes an extraordinary decision which will change her life forever. I have no idea.
I've never heard of
a description for so many films.
Yeah. It's very generic, and there's no trailer available either. Also out this week, A Sicilian Ghost Story, which screened at ATIFF earlier this year.
It's getting pretty good reviews, actually.
Pretty good notices. Graham saw it and reviewed it for the site, and I think was actually quite fond of it as well. So you can check out his review if you want. My film of the week and my Mamma Mia experience, Teen Titans Go to the Movies, is out this week.
I did see the trailer for this. It did look like tremendous fun.
It is the best superhero movie of the summer.
Oh.
And there's another one being released this week. Wow. It's great fun. It's a movie that's made by people who love what they're doing. It's a collection of vignettes. It's got musical numbers. It's old-style Warner Brothers animation. It's playful. It's funny. It's based on the infamous Cartoon Network Teen Titans Go cartoon, which featured a 10-minute episode in which Robin explains how to build equity. It's
okay.
It's staggering.
Why not?
There's an amazing, there are like countless amazing sequences, some great gags in this. This is the only time that I've laughed at Bruce Wayne's parents being killed on screen. It's fantastic.
Good Lord. Okay.
It's wonderful. There's it riffs very well off everything from Christopher Nolan's movies to the fact that Aquaman has a movie. It's
which
a movie,
still staggers me, quite
it's
frankly.
Premised around the idea that Robin, who is as the ward of a billionaire playboy genius philanthropist, has become an arch capitalist, has discovered that all the other superheroes have movies. And so he decides that there's only one thing for it. He's got to go and get himself a movie in Hollywood, involving various hilarious schemes, including going back in time and reversing every superhero origin ever. It's fantastic.
Can I ask a question? Is this all ages suitable kids kind of film? Or
it is. In fact, the biggest problem with the film is that it's very much aimed, not in a problem, but it does have a lot of bodily function related humor in a way that farts are funny.
Farts are funny.
Farts are funny
in fairness,
sometimes, but I feel like it can get a little bit grating. But it is all ages appropriate. It's funny. It's witty. It's well observed. You'll laugh depending on, no matter how familiar or unfamiliar you are with everything. It's very, very worth a look. And the other big superhero movie release of the week is Ant-Man and the Wasp, Peyton Reed's sequel to the original Ant-Man.
I will see this. I liked Ant-Man a lot. More than most, I suspect. I thought it was terrific fun.
Well, it works very much in the same way that Ant-Man did, which is Marvel, after they released the... it was Age of Ultron in 2015... obviously Infinity War this summer. You have these big, bombastic superhero releases, so you literally go small.
So this is almost like a almost self-contained.
It's very much a palate cleanser. It's a movie without. It's the first Marvel movie that actually makes the lack of a strong villain or antagonistic character a feature rather than a bug. It's playful. It's, you know, it's jokey. Paul Rudd is charming. It fixes the biggest issues that existed with the original Ant-Man, which is that it was very much one of those films from around 2014-2015 where you had a goofy male lead and a hyper-competent female supporting character, whereas what Ant-Man and the Wasp does is it inverts that a little bit. It very much makes the hyper-efficient female lead very much the lead as well.
I said to Darren and Niall earlier, and it's worth repeating because it gave me a laugh. Peter Bradshaw's review of it, he gave 4 stars, which is not bad, but Bradshaw was very generous sometimes in the review. But his opening line, the opening words of his review was like, the two great enemies of Picnic. and the Wasp.
That's good.
Which made me laugh, and I thought it was worth reading.
But it is. It's good fun. It's very light. It has no real sense of structure or story. The stakes are remarkably and endearably low.
I'm happy with
that.
Which
is fantastic.
Like, the best part of the Ant-Man
world can't always be in.
Yeah. The original Ant-Man had like a kind of a train sequence on a Thomas Tank Engine in the room, which was charming, wonderful. When the train blew up, went out of the house, then the eyes moving in the street. Yeah. Stuff like that always kills me. Like, and he did it really well.
Yeah, and I mean, and it's interesting because, again, I've been to the cinema several times. I've seen the trailer for this several times. The trailer, interestingly enough, makes a point to play up this idea of world-ending apocalypse, and that it has a line from Michael Pena where he's like, oh, she's trying to destroy the world or something, which doesn't appear in the final cut of the film. And the only the only shot of anything exploding in the entire movie is shoehorned into the trailer at that point.
Yeah.
So you can tell that someone at Disney or Marvel was like, oh crap, we gotta have stakes in the trailer.
Of course.
But that's
not a bad sell to get it in, but I'm happy enough that I'm probably seeing this and Mission Impossible over the weekend.
Very excited about Michelle Pfeiffer.
She is unfortunately somewhat underused. Ant-Man and the Wasp, much like Ant-Man before it, has perhaps the most overqualified supporting cast of the entire Marvel Cinematic Universe. In that, like, there's Judy Greer and Bobby Cannavale here who show up just to deliver lines and exposition and then wander off and then wander back in later to deliver more exposition and wander off.
Didn't do a whole lot more in the first one.
No, they didn't.
Bobby Cannavale did a little bit more.
Well, that's what I'm saying. It's very much an overqualified cast.
Why not? Why not? I'm fine with that.
It does make good use of Michael Pena. As ever.
He's a bit of a treasure in the first instance.
Michael Pena is amazing.
He's fantastic,
I would watch a spin-off movie.
Oh, me too.
I would watch, like, Avengers 4, like, not to spoil the ending of Avengers 3, but
which
Avengers
I haven't
4,
seen, Darren.
Okay, should consist entirely of Michael Pena narrating the events of the Marvel Cinematic Universe with, like, Chris Hemsworth and Chris, sort of, Evans doing the bit while he's talking.
Yeah, I'd watch that, because the first Ant-Man gets a lot of change.
Mileage
out of that. Like,
it really does. This one adds Randall Park as well.
Remind me who Randall Park is.
Randall Park is, I believe, fresh off the boat.
I haven't seen that, but I've heard great things about it. That's a sitcom, isn't it?
It's sitcom.
Yeah.
He's very good. He's charming. He's the FBI handler.
Very
Again,
good.
Not used as well as he could be. Overqualified supporting cast. But, I mean, you know.
Still, faces are faces. Like, it's good to have them in it.
Yeah, it's hard to complain about having that many people you like in such a confined and small space together.
I mean.
Take it easy. We'll be back next week. But until then, if you want a bit more Jay in your life, you can follow him at...
J. Coyle for all your film related news.
You can follow Ronan at...
I'm on Twitter at Baron Ronan and barking on about all manner of stuff in Sin Aaron.
You can follow me at Darren_Mooney at the 250. It's the podcast that I host about the IMDb 250, and this week we're covering Christopher Nolan's The Prestige, which is a film I watched 3 times in the space of a week and a
You're
half.
You're covering a Christopher Nolan film? I am.
What a
shocked.
Surprise. Oh,
shocked,
don't worry.
I tell you.
I have more news, but we'll talk about that later.
Oh.
Bye, guys.
Bye.
Bye-bye.